Previously on Beta.
You see, the Lunar Council knows we've been captured. It's up to those Navy boys now to confuse Arcturus and his Mothmen into letting us get control of the communications reactors.
Well, scramble my feedback!
Oh, damn. Now I see it.
Ladies and gentlemen, an impromptu surprise for you. The Haynes Sisters!
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta. Today, Francesca T. Royster. She's the author of the fascinating book, Black Country Music, Listening for Revolutions. It includes such pioneers as Tina Turner and the late Charlie Pride, who was country music's first black superstar.
I think that what's so exciting to me is the ways that current black country music artists are working together.
Also, award-winning actress and TV writer Tracy Dawson talks about her debut book, Let Me Be Frank, a book about women who dressed like men to do they weren't supposed to do.
As soon as she got on that ferry with her bike, I'm already like, bravo, young woman.
But first, Bill Oakley. You might remember Bill from his previous appearance on Beta. He joined us a while back to talk about his life as a showrunner and head writer of The Simpsons and his side hustle as the Gordon Ramsay of fast food. But Bill being Bill, he's always got some other creative projects going. His latest is probably his most ambitious and audacious adventure yet, an Audible original series called Space 1969. It imagines an alternative universe in which John F. Kennedy was not assassinated. In this timeline, JFK ends the Vietnam War and is preparing to open a moon colony. Natasha Lyonne stars as a night nurse named Nancy who works on a lunar space station. Space 1969 is 5.5 hours of highly produced Oakley-esque mirth and mayhem. Bill joined us from his home in Portland, Oregon to give us the lowdown on the hijinks and how he came up with this.
It was an idea that I had. I've had this idea for at least 15 years in various forms, and not so much the idea that you see, or rather that you hear in the current version, but it's a setting, basically. A setting in which, and I'm not the first to come up with this idea, obviously, it's a setting in which John F. Kennedy survived the assassination. Part of that was inspired by that Stephen King book, 11-22-63, which deals with that exact subject.
Mm-hmm.
But I always thought it would be funny if, well, he survived, but he wasn't quite right. And that's kind of the premise of this whole, the setting that the whole series takes place in, is that John F. Kennedy survived the assassination attempt, but when he woke up, he wasn't quite the same.
How do you do? Good morning, all.
President Kennedy, could I have your autograph?
Of course. Where are you from, young man?
Dallas, Texas, sir.
Lovely city. I visited Dallas years back. Left a bit of myself there. My left eyeball, to be exact.
You're a peach. Keep fighting the good fight.
With every last ounce of my breath.
Mr. Kennedy, would you take a picture with my son?
I would be delighted.
Go on, Freddy. Stand next to him.
Would you like to go to space someday, Freddy?
You bet, sir. The moon, Mars, you name it.
We're gonna build quite an empire, aren't we? Paint the galaxy red, white, and blue?
Huh, I can't wait.
Quite a boy you have here. Make sure he's registered for selective service.
He's only 8.
His time will come.
And one of the ways in which he wasn't the same was that he decided to immediately end the war in Vietnam and spend all of America's resources expanding into space as quickly as possible. And that's where we are when we begin. Space 1969 is his inauguration day for his third term.
Yeah, so it's really kind of like, would it be fair to describe Space 1969 maybe as revisionist history, Bill Oakley style?
Sort of. It is. I mean, it's more like it's a sci-fi retro comedy, which puts it into three different niches, which is why it would never be appropriate for television, but makes a fine audiobook.
Yeah. And although it wouldn't be appropriate for television, just because, why? It would be too expensive to make it?
Yeah.
Like five, yeah.
It's also, that's the thing that is very annoying about television, and I have to say, having worked in television for 30 years, is, well, they justifiably, they always want to go for the biggest audience possible. So, in general, TV executives hate period pieces because people, you know, the average person is not that familiar with the past and they hate, and they hate sci-fi except on the Sci-Fi Channel. And so like it's a triple niche, as I said, and therefore, and this originally was at one point a television project and it was rejected for those specific reasons. Although everyone thought it was very funny, they were like, this is too smart for the audience basically, which is why it's, you know, worked out far better as an audiobook.
Yeah, yeah. If you had to do it for TV, to riff off of Seinfeld, you weren't going to dumb it down for some mass bonehead audience.
That's the hard part. And I think it still would make a pretty fine animated show. And there have been some discussions about that. But it's still not, you know, it would be a big risk for whoever took it on. And I don't blame them. I don't like it. That's why I don't, that's one of my complaints about the TV business is the, you know, the numerous levels of gatekeepers that have these prescribed philosophies that keep certain types of things off the air.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing that I found particularly interesting is that most stories about space take place in the future, but Space 1969 is set in the past. Why did you want to set the story in 1969?
You know, it's an interesting confluence of things because, number one, it sets the tone. This whole thing is about the Kennedy administration, the third term of the Kennedy administration to a large extent. And part of the underpinnings of this whole thing is it's a little bit based on Star Wars. And my observation that, you know, the people, the average person living under the Emperor and Darth Vader was probably like, all right, we're part of the Empire, man. We're kicking ass. And and so like, we were like America. And I figured, you know, that's exactly what would happen with America. If America had a very charismatic leader like John F. Kennedy, people would definitely take a lot of liberties with their opinions as long as we were still doing great. And that's what's happening in this when we begin the series. The Kennedy's in his third term. He has 92% approval rating. The stock market is at a record high. Unemployment is at a record low. And part of what is part of our setting is it's a little bit of exploration of that.
How did you pitch it to Audible?
This is a weird thing. Audible only has two types of things. They have an audiobook. They have audiobooks and podcasts. And up till a few hours before this thing was released, we still couldn't figure out whether this was an audiobook or a podcast. So it's kind of both. It's really like a radio show. It's like an old-time radio show, 10 episodes of a half hour a piece. The thing, the real breakthrough was the creation of the character of Nurse Nancy, who was the star of the show. See, in all previous versions of Space 1969, that character didn't exist.
Oh, wow.
And the breakthrough. I was like, we need a person to star in this show. The person, you know, we don't want it to be all about the White House machinations of John F. Kennedy. We want it to be about the average, as I said, the average person's experience in this particular setting. And so thus I created the character of Nurse Nancy. And from 2 days into it, I was like, this has to be Natasha Lyonne.
5:02 p.m. Okay. All right. I got nearly an hour till I have to be at the infirmary. Goddamn graveyard shift. There is no graveyardier thing than working the graveyard shift in space. Maybe working in a space graveyard? Well, that'd be just my luck. All right, Barbara, Kiki, anyone? It's me, Nancy. I'm going to take a shower.
I wrote the whole thing with her in my head, with her saying every line, and we were lucky enough to actually get her. It was a remarkable occurrence.
So yeah, definitely. What would have happened if you were unable to get her?
I'm sure we would have cast someone else, but it might not have been someone with the comic chops that Natasha has. Or I might have had to rewrite every Nurse Nancy line, all 4,000 of them, to accommodate a different actress.
Yeah. I'm guessing the biggest challenge you faced was writing a story that lasts for 5 hours and 35 minutes. How did you pull that off?
It was an immense challenge. Yes, it took a lot of mapping out. You know, I wanted a story that had a number of twists and turns that would keep the listener involved and have a little bit of a cliffhanger at the end of each of the 10 episodes.
He didn't die in the hotel.
Wait, what?
He was found at the bottom of a gyroscopic stabilization shaft.
How dramatic.
Thanks. I said it that way intentionally.
And so it took a lot of construction to make that work. Also because basically when people listen to this, they'll know you're tracking three major stories in this. And so I kind of intertwined the three stories so that each one would play off one another. And then also when there was a, that each one of them had a cliffhanger towards the end of each episode. So it did take a lot of mapping out and on a big document, you know, over a period of weeks. And it was also, this is the longest thing I ever, I mean, I wrote this by myself, and it was, the script was 552 pages. I mean, this was a lot of work.
Well, so what was that like, not having someone to bounce ideas off of?
It was a process that I had to muster a lot of self-discipline that I don't usually have and say, you're going to sit down and you're going to write 10 pages of script every single day until this is done. And I did it. And basically, as with a lot of writing, the hardest part is getting started. And the first 15 minutes are always like jumping into an ice cold pool. But then when you start rolling, it's a little bit easier. And honestly, writing this was not that different than writing Simpsons, which is, I'm mainly known for my work on The Simpsons, but other animated shows. Because those are done almost as radio shows. The Simpsons was done almost as a radio show with the actors standing around, and it does rely on a lot of audio initially before the animators come in. And so I wrote this using the Simpsons script format, and it was very much, honestly was kind of just like writing a Simpsons script, except I had to describe stuff. Like, you couldn't rely on people to on people seeing things. So I had to, and I made a joke out of that many times in this thing, where people would be describing things that they clearly would be seeing. But I decided that's also why I needed a narrator. And without spoiling too much, the narrator is a major character in the entire series.
Yes, and the narrator, you often break the fourth wall and go kind of meta, especially with the case of the narrator, whose name I won't reveal because it sounds like you don't want us to, but he's often, he's interrupted by his wife or something, and he says, I'm narrating here. I'm not finished narrating.
I'm happy to reveal it, but we should just tell anybody who wants to listen to this, they should come back. Everyone listening now should know that the conversation is now going to go into some spoilers. So if you want to hear, if you want to be completely unspoiled, you should listen to Space 1969 and then come back and listen to the remainder of this interview.
The Liberty Bell was the hub of America's expansion into space. And
are you ready for your lunch?
I'm narrating here.
But I brought you...
Later. Can't you see I'm narrating?
How did the recording process go?
It was extremely strange because this was during the height of COVID, and every single person was recorded at home. Audible had an incredibly complex system of shipping record, basically miniature recording studios to every actor, every one of our 70 actors, including myself. I play a role in the show, that you would set up. They had a computer that they would control remotely. They had microphones and so forth. And it was really a complex process that all happened from my part, happened here at my desk, at the desk of Thomas Mann, and at the desk of each individual or closet, as it may be, of each individual actor.
And I imagine you were coaching the actors, right? Like telling them to say, could you say it this way? Do the line a different way?
Yes. Yeah. And in some cases, I mean, I was there with Thomas throughout. Thomas did a lot of the recording. I directed the vast majority of it. And I have a lot of experience directing actors in this realm because that's been my career. But for instance, like Natasha didn't need any, she barely needed any coaching because, as I said, I wrote the lines in her voice, and she knew where the jokes were and she knew how to say them. So we actually were able to record all several thousand of her lines in 2 days.
Wow. And you've said on Twitter, and you've said it in this interview, I believe, that Space 1969 is the best, funniest, and longest thing you've ever written. It's obvious. We've talked about why it's the longest thing you've ever written. But why do you think it is your best and funniest work?
Because I didn't write it to please anybody but me. That's the thing, that's the remarkable thing. It did not have to go through a development process like every other project I've ever done. And in this case, I was able to be incredibly self-indulgent, and I'm so glad that the audience has responded, because every single time I was like, is this guy? I never thought, will the audience get this? I thought, do I find this funny? And that's why there's so many things that are like, they're very obscure. Many of these references are extremely obscure references to things from the 60s. That I was only 2 or 3 years old when these things occurred, but I happened to be a student of that era. And there's an infinite number of references to things like the Laugh-In, which most people probably never saw and never heard of. But the amount of time and attention that went into recreating fictional scenes from Laugh-In was astonishing. And I think, as I said, the team at Audible did it so well.
And The Dating Game is another kind of what would be an obscure reference for many.
Oh my God, they found the guy, they found a guy who sounds just like Jim Lang. I listened to that. Jim Lang was the host of The Dating Game, for people who don't know. I listened to that thing 30 times because it just sounds like it really happened. And that sounds like Jim Lang, who most people don't remember. But like, to me, I was like, oh my God, it's like we have recreated things from the past that never existed.
Yeah. And his catchphrase that, and here they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. When he introduced, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's uncanny how much the actor you got to do that sounds like Jim Lang. Yeah. Do you have a favorite scene in Space 1969?
That is a very tough question. I have hundreds of favorite scenes. One, and these are going to contain spoilers.
Mm-hmm.
I particularly love the scene where Richard Nixon goes to Gimbel's to buy a shirt.
I need a men's dress shirt, white, and I'm in a hurry.
Of course, sir. What?
I don't know my size.
No problem at all. May I just take your measurements?
If you must. What is with this decor? This aluminum foil and what?
Oh, it's a kind of an outer space theme. Astronauts, lunar landers, and all that. To go with the inauguration. Kind of groovy, don't you think?
Yeah. Did you hear me say I'm in a hurry?
15-inch collar, 35-inch sleeve. Would you like to try it on? The dressing room is right
yes,
over
fine,
there.
Yes, fine, but quickly.
That's one of my favorite scenes, and it's constructed of it. The audio is absolutely brilliant.
It
there's
is.
There's a number of other scenes. Gosh, there's many scenes with Natasha that I just keep. They're so funny. Natasha on the Nancy on the Dating Game. I love the scene where she and JFK are hanging out in the White House bowling alley. And bowling and smoking cigars. This is going to sound crazy to people who have not heard this, but it all comes about very naturally. Oh, and of course her, I'm not going to spoil it. Say some of her interactions with Richard Nixon late in the, in a different setting, late in the series, also make me laugh like crazy.
Mm-hmm. I understand that you're working on a sequel, Space 1970. What can you tell us about it?
Where did you hear about that?
I read it somewhere online.
Oh, well, I can't go into too much detail.
Okay.
At the moment, but it is Space 1972 is what it's called now.
Oh, okay.
And I have the story all worked out, and I won't go into any more detail, but I will say that at the moment, it looks like it may actually happen, which is a thrill. I haven't been so excited about any work developments in a very long time, and writing Space 1972 is going to be absolutely fantastic.
Bill Oakley, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Space 1969. Looking forward to Space 1972.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Bill Oakley is the creator of the Audible original audiobook, Space 1969. Find out more about Bill and Space 1969 at wpr.org/beta.
Old Town Road is important for this younger generation, both as a way of kind of giving them a way to be resistant and to connect with each other.
Hootie and the Blowfish's Darius Rucker is just one story in the rich history of Black country music. Coming up, author Francesca T. Royster tells us about many more. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Francesca T. Royster's book, Black Country Music, Listening for Revolutions, is one of the most beautifully written music books I've ever read. It's equal parts memoir and music history. She writes intimately about being one of the few Black people to attend a country music festival in the West Loop of Chicago. Francesca admits that hearing the Lynyrd Skynyrd hit Sweet Home Alabama at this festival reminded her of all the reasons she felt wary as a Black woman entering this country music space. Francesca also introduces us to Valerie June. She describes June as a ghost catcher because of her uncanny ability to create new music that honors the past. Francesca's excited about how Black musicians are changing what country music looks and sounds like, and her excitement is contagious. She joined us from her home in Chicago.
I really became a fan once I started leaning into the book and thinking about the histories of the music. Well, I think that part of what I'm responding to is what's happening in terms of public conversations, like the ones that I hear in Rissy Palmer's Color Me Country podcast, or conversations between other Black country music artists about the challenges of being in the industry that, you know, when I was participating in the Country Soul Songbook Summit that Kamara Thomas organizes. So as I was working on the book in the last 5 years or so, I've really seen all of these things coming together, the music itself, new musicians, the conversations about the industry that were happening, you know, in certain venues among Black artists and music producers, and then the scholars and writers who are kind of reflecting and intervening in all of this. So it feels like a really exciting moment right now.
Mm-hmm. That's great to hear. In 1973, Tina Turner recorded the first song that she had written. It's a song called Nutbush City Limits. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, I love that song. I knew it actually as a child. Like, it's a song that I knew as part of the Ike and Tina Turner Review repertoire. But I hadn't really thought about it as autobiographical and its power in terms of really talking about, for Tina Turner, talking about her experience growing up in Tennessee, growing up in the South, and how that experience of living in the South, feeling the tensions, but also the freedoms of that landscape is really a part of her story, and a story that is shared by a lot of African Americans who have migrated from south to north. A church house, gin house, schoolhouse, outhouse, on highway number 19. The people keep the city clean. That guy Nutbush, oh Nutbush. They call it Nutbush City Limits. Nutbush City Limits, I think, is really powerful as this testimony to what it feels like sometimes to be Black in small town Tennessee during the period that she was living in, the 1940s and 50s. And also that it can have a place in popular music, which is what she and Ike did by recording it in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm. Darius Rucker, I want to ask you about Darius Rucker. He is best known as the frontman for Hootie and the Blowfish, a band that was very popular in the mid-90s. And Darius has pivoted to become a country music artist. How has this transition worked out for him?
I think he's been incredibly successful. I would say that if you asked many country music fans to name a Black artist, a contemporary Black artist, Rucker would be kind of on that list. Like, he's probably one of the most visible mainstream country music artists. I think from his example, we really see the very narrow path of Black country music artists, especially Black country music male artists, to both demonstrate their ability to win over audiences, to be listenable and accessible, but also to be non-threatening. And in the chapter, I really thought about the song Wagon Wheel, and really the video for Wagon Wheel, as a very interesting moment where Rucker's kind of thinking he's traveling through this landscape and trying to reach a bar where he's trying to perform. And you kind of see some of the tensions that he has to go through, just in terms of being interfacing with strangers, with white strangers. And there's like this interesting moment where you see him being watched. He's like watching himself being watched. Heading down south to the land of the pines, I'm thumbing my way into North Carolina. Staring up the road and pray to God I see headlights. I made it down the coast in 17 hours, picking me a bouquet of dogwood flowers. And I'm hoping for Raleigh, I can see my baby tonight. So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel. Hey, mama, rock me. And it turns out it's kind of a dream. He wakes up in the video as kind of like a take on The Wizard of Oz, where all the people who were needing to be convinced that he was a good character in the video ends up being part of his music team.
How y'all doing?
Ready, bro?
Right, always ready. Y'all, I just had a crazy dream, and I see y'all after the show.
All right. Knock them dead out there, man.
Thank you, man.
And so there's just like a very interesting way that I see Rucker dramatizing the care that it requires to be a successful Black country music artist.
As you point out, there's a strong possibility that Darius Rucker's great role model for success has been Charlie Pride.
Whenever I chance to meet some old friends on the street, they wonder how does a man get to be this way. I've always got a smiling face, anytime and any place, and every time they ask me why, I just smile and say, you've got to kiss an angel good morning and let her know you think about her when you're gone.
Charlie, of course, was the first African-American country artist associated with a major label.
When Pride first came to Nashville to start his career, he visited Music Row and, you know, had some trouble just kind of convincing people that he could be successful during this time period. And so just thinking about what was happening in terms of the United States, in terms of the South, during the civil rights moment that he was also wanting to start his career, you can kind of think about some of the pressures that he was facing. And so one of the strategies that Pride used was...
So he says, we need to come up with something. You just go in and start singing because you done shocked them. I said, okay, what we do? He says, here's what we come up with. Ladies and gentlemen, I realize it's a little unique, me coming out here on a country music show wearing this permanent sand.
So you worked on that line.
That's what we did.
In the 90s, he wrote a memoir about his life called Pride, and he really talks about what he thought about those moments, especially the moments early in his career. And he talks about feeling unsafe. He talks about, you know, his life being threatened, and he talks about experiencing a kind of racialized hazing from some of the other country music stars that he worked with, and also battling a kind of personal depression at times. So I thought it was really powerful for him at that point to expose some of the tensions of being a Black country music star. And I don't know if that book was very widely read, but I think that for someone like Darius Rucker or for Jimmy Allen or for Mickey Guyton or other contemporary artists, his example has been so important, and the extent to which he was willing to also talk about some of those troubles, maybe with them privately, was probably a really important source of solace for them too, as Guyton or especially as Rucker, strategizing how to be successful as country artists.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, yeah. Let's fast forward to the 2000s when Valerie June got her music career going. Can you tell us about Valerie?
Yeah, Valerie June is so wonderful and unique as an artist because she is someone, first of all, in her voice, in her persona, she's bringing together country, rural identity, and Black identity and claiming it. She's someone as an artist who is also really interested in the archive of past artists. And so her songwriting is really informed by earlier Black country artists and blues artists. And she also embraces what she calls her perfectly imperfect voice, which includes like cracks and, you know, is kind of nasal and is like kind of an everyday, beautiful everyday voice that she says is like the voices that she used to hear when she'd go to church.
Dancing on the Astor Plain, holy water cleansing rain, floating through the stratosphere, drown me, you see so clear. Is there a way for you to shine out of fear?
Her work is so interesting because there's a kind of hominess that's connected to the past, but she's also really interested in imagining futures, and there's a really strong kind of Afrofuturistic kind of utopian aspect to her songs, kind of includes psychedelic sounds and kind of free jazz sounds sometimes in her music.
The banjo has played a very important role in the history of African American music, and the Grammy and MacArthur Award winner Rhiannon Giddens has played a huge role in spreading the word about the banjo. What exactly has she done?
She's so amazing. She's always thinking about how to explore past music forms like the banjo and really connecting them to African-American history and lives, and how to also think about how music is an important force for connecting communities. And I think that's something she does with her Silk Road project. But I appreciate that she often plays a minstrel banjo, which is a banjo that has kind of a lower kind of tenor sound that's based on the banjos that were used in 19th century minstrel shows to kind of get us to hear and rehear the banjo and to think about this history of blackface minstrelsy and the ways that it's shaped popular music and also kind of contributed in some ways to the marginalization of black creativity. So she was reclaiming the banjo and also using it to talk about black history and stories, as she does really well on Songs of Our Native Daughters, where she's taking on stories about enslaved lives or thinking about the commodification of bodies now, or thinking about the ways that we seek spiritual resilience from the ancestors in their song Music and Joy. All of her music, I think, is very healing and also really informed by a difficult history. And she, through her powerful music and her beautiful voice, she kind of helps us to face a history that's sometimes really painful and to heal and connect to others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. Let's talk about Lil Nas X's 2018 hit, Old Town Road. You've identified 13 ways of looking at the song. My favorite way is number 13 on the school bus. Can you tell us about this way?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to have at least some part of the book that's really thinking about how my daughter, Cece, is so much a part of my enjoyment of Lil Nas X and of Black country music in general. And so on the school bus, I was really thinking about how Cece and her friends loved Old Town Road and loved singing it with each other. And I imagined a school field trip where they're singing on the school bus, which Cece said they actually did. And just thinking about the power of that song to connect this very diverse group of kids and the humor and just accessibility of the song. And to me, it was like, it's testimony of how Old Town Road was so infectious for so many people. Can't nobody tell me nothing. You can't tell me nothing. In my writing about it, I was really also thinking about that line, can't nobody tell me nothing, as just like this really fun but also resistant spirit that informs the whole song and might be one reason that I think Old Town Road is important for this younger generation, both as a way of kind of giving them a way to be resistant and to connect with each other, but also provide an example of enjoying country music in a way that isn't segregated or doesn't perpetuate the idea that this isn't your music. This can be anybody's music.
How do you see Black country music evolving?
I think that what's so exciting to me is the ways that current Black country music artists are working together. I think there's a kind of collectivity that and collaboration that I think can change the form. And I'm thinking that whatever else happens in terms of the popularity of bringing Black country music to mainstream audiences like the Grand Ole Opry or the Country Music Association Awards, that these kinds of collaborations are going to push country music as an industry. Black artists and also of other artists, ally artists like Brandi Carlile or others who are really working to create a more permanent place for Black artists. And I think that that will necessarily also change the way that country music sounds like in exciting ways. The sound of country can also include this rootedness that I hear in the music that I've looked at.
Mm, yeah, that would be great. Francesca T. Royster, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Black Country Music, Listening for Revolutions. It's a beautifully written and very captivating book.
Thank you so much, Doug. I really enjoyed talking to you about it.
Francesca T. Royster is the author of Black Country Music, Listening for Revolutions. Find out more about Francesca and her book at wpr.org/beta.
And so she took on these male pseudonyms for different pieces of her writing, so it didn't look like she dominated the magazine.
Coming up, Tracy Dawson introduces us to historical women who refused to take no for an answer. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Tracy Dawson is an award-winning actress and a TV writer who started her career at the Second City in Toronto. She's probably best known for her work on the Canadian sitcom Call Me Fitz, where she won a Canadian Screen Award, Canada's version of the Emmys. Tracy is also the author of Let Me Be Frank. In her book, she profiles brave women who stuck it to the man by dressing like men. Tracy joined us from her home in Los Angeles. She says that this project began as a TV show, but that it ultimately found a home as a witty and untold history of some important women.
I had all this research and I just started writing pages. You know, I just started writing. And then I sent them out to some literary agents. I had a script deal at the time with like a major movie star. So I felt like I could just say like, hey, I've got this script deal. I'm a TV writer in LA. Like, but I just thought this might be a book. Is this a book? Like, I just asked people outright. And the feedback that I got was, yes, this is a book. You should write this book. And so it feels like a higher calling. Like, you know what I mean? I get to be funny. I get to like exercise my voice, my creativity, but also like, I really, really want to tell people about these women. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, I feel like this great support from them almost.
Mm-hmm. And the beauty of writing a book, of course, is that you don't, you have total creative freedom. You don't have to answer to the suits.
I mean, to a certain degree, obviously, you still have editors and publishers and people
true.
Who are like, but yes, I mean, I'm just really glad because that's my voice.
mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah. That's your authentic Dawson-esque voice. And it's very, very different, very unique. It's unique to you. One of the women you wrote about is Ellen Craft. Can you tell us about Ellen?
Yes. Ellen Craft is one of the people that when I came upon her story, first, I was blown away, but then I was angry that I had never heard her story before. I was actually upset. So Ellen Craft was a light-skinned, mixed-race, enslaved woman who escaped from her enslavement along with her husband. She was posing as a white male plantation owner, and her husband passed as her enslaved valet. And so they made it from Georgia all the way up to Free Philadelphia, and they had to take trains and boats. And it was absolutely ingenious. It's the most incredible story of American history that should be known by everybody. So I just was like, I can't believe this incredible story. You know what I mean? Like, you're first blown away and then you're angry because you're just like, wait a second. Why is there a biopic about Elvis out? Sorry, I shouldn't like slam Elvis. But like, honestly, an Elvis biopic and there's no movie about Ellen Craft. Come mm-hmm. on, you people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hopefully your book, people reading about Ellen Craft and her husband, William, hopefully they will that will raise awareness.
The hope is definitely that people would read the book and then want to go down their own rabbit holes. The chapter in the middle, which is called Anonymous Was a Woman, features a lot of authors who wrote using a male pseudonym or anonymously. And so when people reach out to me and go like, I can't wait to read this book and that book and to learn more about this author, and I didn't know this about Jane Austen, it's like, just to see people getting all riled up, I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another one of the remarkable women you write about is Pauline Hopkins. What is Pauline's story?
Pauline was one of the most prominent African-American writers and thinkers during her time. And I write very little about Pauline. She's featured in the Anonymous Was a Woman chapter, but I wanted to include her because she did not disguise herself as a man for protection. I wanted to include her because she took on male pseudonyms in her writing because she was so prolific and she was such a part of that early African-American journal, whose name escapes me at this time. But she was so involved as a writer and editor in that journal that if she had used her real name on all of the pieces that she wrote and all of the discourse that she was a part of, it would have looked, I don't know, I guess to them it would have seemed unseemly, it would have seemed strange. And so she took on these male pseudonyms for different pieces of her writing so it didn't look like she dominated the magazine, which I think is just the coolest because I don't think a lot of people know about Pauline Hopkins. I really hope that people read these like little introductions. You know, I can't go into too much, right? Otherwise, I'd just be writing an entire book about each person. But I hope that they read about Pauline Hopkins and say, oh my gosh, like, I want to seek out her writing. I mean, she also wrote what is some considered is the beginning of Afrofuturism in some of the writing that she did. And that she created a world that some people have compared with Wakanda from Black Panther. So she's incredibly important to the movement and to the especially to Afrofuturists.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's so dense, the book. Yeah, because you really, I don't want to use deep dives, but it's the phrase that's coming to mind now, these deep dives into these people that we've never heard of, these remarkable women, but that we should have heard of. I'm curious, can you point to one woman you wrote about who resonated the most with you?
You know, I really love the story of, well, I don't love the story. I was moved by the story of Dorothy Lawrence. Dorothy Lawrence was a young woman who wanted to be a journalist. So World War I was happening. And she was like, you know what? I'm writing these little puff pieces. You know, they give you women's stuff to write about, like little, probably just tiny little columns. And she said, I want to get to the front. And I want to report on the war. And if I get a real scoop, then people are going to take me seriously. And it was a really big deal. And she was laughed at, you know, all the newspapers and the War Office laughed in her face and said, you know, and she was 18, 19 years old. And she decided, you know what, I'm going to get on the ferry at Folkestone and I'm going to cross the channel. She basically got a little bag put together and she put her bike on the ferry and she went over to France, which is unbelievably incredible to me, like the chutzpah. And so she went over there and she was like sussing everything out, you know, she was like, okay. And she met some like boys from back home and they basically were like, yeah, you could probably get to the front, but you're not going to be able to get there as a woman. And so they helped her get a new ID. They helped her get a uniform. One of them cut off her hair and she made it to the front, which is unbelievable. She was discovered after 10 days, like she made it all the way to the trenches and she was posing with the help of some people from back home, like some other soldiers. She was posing as a sapper. And so what they did was they dug mines and they put explosives in it. It was a big part of trench warfare. And after about 10 days, she was found out and she was taken, you know, as a prisoner. They didn't know if she was a spy. They didn't know what she was. And she kept telling them, you know, I want to be a journalist. I wanted to get to the front. I want to report on it. And it was so mind-boggling to them. They were like, why aren't you at home trying to have children? Like, what are you doing? And so she was cross-examined and she was just interrogated by many, many people. They hold her up in a nunnery because they weren't sure if she was a spy. She eventually was released. She was sent back home. And she was forbidden about writing a word about her experiences until after the armistice, after the war ended. And then she did write a book. And I read that book. And I thought it was absolutely delightful, start to finish, funny, smart, like a great storyteller. And the book was a failure. She was laughed at. She was thought of as a freak. Her story was spun as a failure, like a joke. And I guess it resonates so much with me because I'm someone that goes after things. Like I want something and I go after it and it doesn't always work out, but she had such bravery to do that. And I just feel like her story should have or could have gone a different way. Like she could have been seen as, wow, right? It could have been like, oh my gosh, you brave, young, you know, brash woman. And also she was funny. Like she was clearly a good writer. So anyway, that's the story that I just like love, because to me, in my eyes, as I say in the book, like she's a success. That's all there is to it. As soon as she got on that ferry with her bike, I'm already like, bravo, young woman.
Yeah, indeed. Bravo, young woman, indeed. And I can see, as you were describing her book, Dorothy Lawrence's book, I can see why she resonated with you so much, because it sounded like you were describing your own book. So that was very interesting. If you don't mind my asking, what emotions were you experiencing while you were writing Let Me Be Frank?
Oh, that's a great question. There were times where it was like dark, because when you keep bumping up against stories of women that just wanted to live their lives, pursue their dreams, play sports, like run and play outside, like just basic human stuff, right? When you keep coming up against these stories of it being prevented, stopped, it really wears on you. It can be demoralizing. However, that was not the dominant emotion. The dominant emotion was like, I guess I can't swear on this program, right? You'd have to bleep me out.
We'd have to bleep it, yeah.
I won't swear. It was F yeah. You know what I mean? Mm. It was like, yeah. Look at us. So I felt a lot of pride and a lot of joy and a lot of like excitement to bring these stories. But also there were definitely moments where, you know, I needed to take a lie down. I mean, the witch chapter, the chapter about the witch pricker.
Oh yeah, which I wanted to ask you about. Oh, yeah, can you tell us a bit about the witch pricker since you brought it up?
Sure. I mean, obviously the witch hunts of the 1600s were super intense. They were particularly intense in Scotland. Christian Cottle was a woman who, I suppose, we don't have all the details. You have to fill in a little bit of the blanks with her story. But she disguised herself as a man to take on the role of witch pricker. Witch pricking is not something I'd ever heard of before I started researching this book. You know, one of the modes that they would try to discover if you were a witch, right? So there's some really horrific modes, everything made up, all a joke, all a terrible pantomime, this whole part of history. You know, let's throw her in the water and see if she floats or she sinks, like this kind of a test. But one of the other modes was witch pricking. They'll take a long needle, which looks like it's from a David Cronenberg horror film, and stick it into the person's body. And if there's no pain or no blood resulting from this pricking, then you're a witch and you're going to be sentenced to die. As I say in the book, it should come as no surprise that the majority of the people that were found to be witches were women. Mm. And so Christian Cottle was like, you know what? I don't know. I just think of her as like kind of an opportunist, right? Which is like, I can disguise myself as a man and I can do this and, you know, make some money. And I'm thinking also self-preservation. If I'm disguised as a witch pricker, I won't be accused of witchcraft. So, I mean, it was such a heavy chapter to research because of just the violence and the, like, it's just all made up. Everything is just made up, and so many people died and were tortured. And so it was definitely like heavy. Oof.
Yeah. What have you learned about yourself from writing this book?
I have learned that I love research. I truly do. Before I start any script, like when I have an idea for a script or a show, sometimes I just have an inkling. I want it to be like something set here or something about this. It's like, and I do a lot of research. I do a lot of reading. Like if I know that it's going to be set in whatever city, I just want to know everything about that city. Like I want to be in that city. Well, not physically. I mean, if I had all the money in the world, I would travel all over and do all my research on the land. But, but you know, I want to immerse myself. And so when it came to writing the book, like I talked to people who are researchers, actually, after the fact, they were like, wow, you're like a natural researcher. I felt so proud, because the thing is that I was just never satisfied with one or two sources. You know what I mean? Like I just knew, because historically, something that the book is actually pointing out is the people that get left off the page, the stories and the history that often doesn't get as much attention, because the people that are historically writing these books are old white guys, right? Just trying to cross-reference, to dig up stuff, to have multiple sources so that you can pick up on something that maybe one historian person just thinks is a throwaway. you know, and you go, wait, what was that? And then you can go down your own rabbit hole and like then just try to back stuff up. And it was just kind of exciting. Like there's a Joan of Arc chapter, right? And it's like a lot of people know about Joan of Arc, but they might not know that one of the main crimes that sent her to the stake was wearing men's clothing. Like that was one of the main things. Maybe people don't know that angle of the story. You know what I mean? And so I did so much reading about her, and it's like, you think you know everything and you realize like, oh no, there's a lot. You can read transcripts from the trial. It's incredible.
Yeah. And I did not know that about Joan of Arc. So yeah, thank you for all the knowledge you've given to us. Tracy Dawson, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Let Me Be Frank, a book about women who dressed like men to do they weren't supposed to do.
Thank you so much, Deb.
That was Tracy Dawson. Her book, Let Me Be Frank, will be featured on WPR's Chapter a Day, beginning on January 17th. Find out more about Tracy and where you can listen to her book at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Bill Oakley, Francesca T. Royster, and Tracy Dawson. Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Don't forget to offer a rating or to share with new alphas. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
I just don't have a place for dollars in my life anymore.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
No, I prefer them when he's drunk. It's all the rest of the time I have the problem with.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
You're more one of life's good guys.
You're more one of life's good guys. Aye.